You know, Gladys, in the 19th century, before the Lumiere brothers were to transform mass entertainment, before mass travel, before the modern Olympics, there was pretty much only one place where ordinary folk could go to feel connected to the wider world. International exhibitions. They started with the Crystal Palace in London in the 1850s. They packaged up the world and they delivered it to audiences in far-flung corners. Great halls of science and machines, cornucopia of consumer goods and curiosities, and exciting world-first innovations. For example, Chicago in 1893 had the world's first Ferris wheel, courtesy of Mr. Ferris, and they unveiled the world's first hamburger, courtesy of Mr. Ham. St. Louis in 1904 gave us the first ice cream cone, I kid you not. But it was the Melbourne International Exhibition in Melbourne, that's a tautology, in 1880, that had the first lawnmower, which I think is absolutely appropriate to a garden-obsessed country that would later be dominated by what I used to call the brick venereal disease. Well, there's a new exhibition in Melbourne that showcases the collection of one man who went to the Melbourne International Exhibition of 1880. Boy, did he buy a big... I think the only thing he didn't get was the lawnmower. More on him a little later. Joining me now is Charlotte Smith. Charlotte is the Senior Curator, Public Life and Institutions at Museum Victoria, and she's appropriately in the Melbourne studio. Charlotte, welcome to the Little Wireless Program.
Thank you much for, very much, Philip.
As an ex-Melburnian, I'd like you to tell the listener what a wonderful place Melbourne was in the 1880s. So sophisticated, so wealthy.
Well, it was. It was actually sort of the wealthiest empire colony in the empire, and it was sort of basking the richest gold rush in the world. It had the highest rate of home ownership in the world. Victorians were earning some of the highest wages in the world. There were new buildings going up around Melbourne
all
the time.
What went wrong, Charlotte? What went wrong?
The Depression of 1893, when it all went bust.
Okay, exactly. But we'll stay in the sort of the warm inner glow of triumphalism. So manufacturing was also making Victoria rich, wasn't it?
It was indeed, and sort of the tariffs on trade ensured that manufacturing was happening within Victoria and the Victorians could actually benefit from it as a result. They were manufacturing huge locomotives in Castlemaine. All along the river area in sort of Richmond and South Yarra, there were a number of sort of small factories.
And a lot of their output, the most theatrical things they made, found their way into the main hall at the exhibition.
They did indeed, exactly. And there they could sort of show themselves on the world stage as being as equal to anyone from Europe or the Americas, as competitive, as sophisticated, as cosmopolitan. And, you know, they were there to sort of flaunt their wares and sort of set up trade links, essentially, with these great trading partners.
Charlotte, I hope you've got them all together again, all these machines at Huff and Puff.
No, the collection we've acquired is a tiny bit smaller in scale than that.
But it's fascinating in and of itself. Look, tell the listener how big this exhibition grounds were, because I had no idea they were so extensive.
No idea. Well, no, exactly. Today all you can see is what was the Great Hall, the Royal Exhibition Building, but there were actually 22 acres of exhibits. So that's about 9 hectares, apparently. There were 32,000 exhibits on display, so and most of them were available for purchase. 37 nations came out to Australia to flaunt their wares. And, of course, the Australian colonies were also represented. So it was an absolutely vast complex. It went from, for those that know Melbourne, for those that don't, I apologise, but basically it covered what is the Grand Palace today. It went down to Rathdown and Nicholson Street, and it covered what is today Melbourne Museum and beyond. So it went into what are sort of the North Gardens. So it was an absolutely enormous complex.
So no wonder people went back again and again, which accounts for the extraordinary ticket numbers. 1.5 million people visiting the exhibition when the population was only a bit over 250,000.
Yes, and Melbourne itself only had a population of 260,000, so in fact it was an astronomical number of people. There were a lot of repeat visits, but there were also people that came from the other colonies and from overseas, sort of merchants, people that came out on sort of warships. They were here for the opening ceremony, and they, I'm sure they then went to the exhibitions whilst they were here. So it was an absolutely, it was the place to be seen. So if you're a wealthy person about town, you would certainly have gone to the exhibitions and gone on more than one occasion.
As a loyal Melburnian, we always sort of blew raspberries at Sydney and In fact, the Sydney-Melbourne thing had been going on for as long as I can remember. So I won't mention the fact that Sydney had one the year before. It was a rotten one, though, wasn't it?
It wasn't to the same scale, although it was a very comprehensive exhibition. And Melbourne did hope to hold one in 1879, but didn't quite get its act into gear in time. The Victorian government was very supportive of it eventually, but it had to go through all the machinations of politics, as things do.
Were these, so it took a bit of time. Were these allocated by some international authority? Was there an Olympic bid procedure?
Not quite in those days, no. You basically had to have your own government support for it. So we had what was called the New Exhibitions Bill of 1878, which basically the Victorian government said, we will invest in this. We will basically provide the £250,000 that were required to build the building and to host the competition, the architectural competition. They then sort of appointed a group of commissioners who were sort of wealthy merchants and also largely often, I should say, politicians. And so these gentlemen of Melbourne really sort of...
And we are talking gentlemen, aren't we?
Oh, we're absolutely talking gentlemen, yes. Yeah. I mean, a lot of women obviously went to the exhibitions. They visited the exhibitions. It was a place where women could actually go unchaperoned. There were lots of places for secret assignations. So women definitely
really?
Went to...
Really? Assignations were going
yes,
on?
Yes, yes.
So it was a sexhibition as well?
I have heard that said of it, yes.
So, no wonder people kept going back.
Going back, exactly.
Again and again and again. Something else I didn't realise, I don't realise anything much really, but I didn't realise that one of the largest exhibits was from British India. What was going on there?
Well, of course, India and Victoria were very similar. We were both sort of important colonies of the empire. And India in 1880 was very, very keen to establish strong trading links with an incredibly wealthy colony, Victoria. So they sent out a lot of things like economic botany, natural products. They also sent out sort of things like costume, furniture, clay figures, which represented sort of the castes and people of India.
Could you get a good cup of tea there?
Oh, you could. There were also two Hindus, attired after the fashion of the day, who would serve you tea in the Indian court as well. So tea was obviously one of the products that the Indian Commission were very, very keen to sell to the Australian markets.
God, it's hard to get a good cup of tea these days, I've got to tell you. It breaks my heart hearing this. Now, looking through some of the exhibits, there seems to have been a big emphasis on porcelain.
Yes, or as one commentator was heard, or one visitor was heard to say, a lot of crockery. There was an awful amount of really fine porcelain, sort of majolica, faience, high porcelain, Dresden, Meissen, Sèvres, Wedgwood. There was a wonderful, wonderful array of porcelains.
You make that sound almost as sexy as sex when you.
I have to admit, I'm a bit of a fan of porcelain.
Would have driven the Toorak Society into a frenzy, all that porcelain.
I think it probably did, and they certainly, I mean, when you see the images of it, and we have a fabulous collection of historical archival images of these displays, it's just layer upon layer upon layer of ceramics in these wonderful, broad, you know, gaudy sort of brash colours of the sort of majolica allowed.
So in a sense, it was many Melburnians' first exposure to an aspect that one might describe as modern art.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, international exhibitions were essentially about the sort of the formation of the consumer society. And seeing all of this sort of material en masse, the first time really in Victoria, it was kind of like, I kind of think it must have been like candy. You know, you just would have gone in there and just absorbed it all and had to buy, you know, because it would have been incredibly rich. Very sensuous materials and lots of wonderful glassware as well and enamelled pieces. It's I have to admit, when I go back in my time machine, I'm going to the 1880 exhibition because I would love to have seen that complete magic that would have been those exhibitions.
The ABC TARDIS in Melbourne does in fact double as a time machine. And I'll give you the codes later. You just punch it in, anything you like. Incidentally, we should dwell for a moment on the Great Hall, which is still quite awe-inspiring. That was the largest building in Australia, was it not, at the time?
It was indeed, yes. And it was actually built, hard to tell in Melbourne today, but it is in fact slightly above the city, if that makes sense. So it was this wonderful lookout over the city too. And the dome, you could actually go up to the promenade and sort of look out over the whole of the city.
Wasn't there a lift that you could go up to the dome?
The lift actually was installed in the 1888 exhibition. In 1880, you had to climb up the 80 stairs. And men, women and children did do that. So, you know, the wonderful images of them up there sort of looking at the, surveying the city of Melbourne below them.
Now, as well as the porcelain and the dome of the Great Hall, the there were lots of concerts, weren't there? Organs, piano recitals, the newest music from France and Germany.
Correct. There was a, an organ was built. It was available for the opening at 1880. Although apparently it wasn't really completed until December, so it was a very large Fincham organ. Thankfully, there was a smaller organ in the south transept where you could have other concerts. There were regular piano recitals in some of the smaller courts, so the German court or the French court or the British court. On a daily basis, a new newspaper was printed telling you what activities were on for the day, so you could sort of turn up and plan your day for, you know, you could almost go from concert to concert or from a particular sort of event in a tea hall onto a concert, onto some other sort of demonstration.
Now, my eyes are blurring over the 1.5 million people who attended, and I'm focusing now on a bloke over there on the right who's John Twycross. Tell us about him.
John Twycross, he emigrated to Australia in 1853. He came out with a brother and a sister, and they came out ostensibly to set up the sort of the Australian arm of a very successful wool stapling business based in Wokingham in England. John sort of settled and established himself in Melbourne.
Whereabouts, for instance? Was he a Toorakian or a South Yarra-ish person?
When he built his house, it was actually in Elsternwick.
Right.
And he actually built a house in the 1860s, and he added an art wing to it. He married Charlotte Burrell, who was from the McRae homestead down on Arthur's Seat. They had two children, so I like to think that, in fact, the whole family went shopping at the exhibition because, in fact, there's a lot of gendered pieces and there's children's toys and things too. So I do think it was a family visiting. John was an art collector, and at his death in 1889 or shortly following it, there are actually two auctions of his collection, one auction completely dedicated to the paintings in his collection and the other one to what they called bric-a-brac. So that includes things like the decorative arts, cloisonné, ivory carvings, etc., a lot of Dresden that he'd actually purchased from the exhibition building. But there was also a sizable quantity of material that he decided to keep that's been handed down to the family.
And what was his wife's name?
Charlotte Burrell.
How eerie that I'm talking to you, Charlotte. Are you perhaps the reincarnation of this?
I do sometimes wonder, exactly.
Because that would explain your passion for this, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
So, isn't it wonderful that the Twycross family kept a lot of this stuff together so it could be donated?
It's fabulous. It's been in the same family for four generations. They have effectively curated it. You know, they've loved it, they've cared for it, and it's been handed down with that fabulous provenance. And the donation recently through John's great-grandson, Will Twycross, is an incredibly generous donation to the museum. And, you know, it provides this fabulous lens onto the Melbourne International Exhibition through the objects that have been saved and, you know, handed down as a collection.
I'm just looking through the list of goodies here. I can't wait to come down and have a look at this. He loved ivory, didn't he, John?
He did indeed. And we have a lot of Japanese...
You have trouble getting it in now.
He would, yes. But given that it's the 19th century, when things were slightly different then and people didn't have the same car qualms.
Elephants everywhere.
Exactly.
Like bloody rabbits they were.
Exactly. So, and he's got some beautiful carvings. He's also a predominantly Japanese, but a couple of Chinese carvings and some Indian boxes as well.
I mentioned this because many years ago I bought a little ivory piece dating from the Roman era, and they wouldn't let it into Australia. I had to get the minister for whatever, Barry Cohen, to give me a special dispensation. I said, look, this elephant that this is made of lived and died before Jesus, you know, but the bureaucrats were totally unsympathetic.
Ivory is ivory, exactly.
Yeah, look, this is great. I understand that you're giving a speech at the opening.
Oh, well, tomorrow it's actually at the Johnston Collection. So I should sort of say, in fact, that we've only just recently acquired this collection. It was donated to us formally about 6 weeks ago. And so, in fact, it's currently being conserved at the museum. And the actual exhibition is going to be in a virtual form, and that's going to be coming up in a couple of years' time. Well, I'm going to be working on it over the next couple of years and writing a book.
Well, it's your fault of being the reincarnation of...
Charlotte Burrell, exactly. So tomorrow, in fact, I'm giving a presentation at the Johnston Collection about John's collection and talking about the specific objects within the collection.
Okay, and the public can sort of bowl along?
They can indeed, yes. I believe there are still a few seats available, so they'd obviously have to contact the Johnston Collection early in the morning. It's a morning presentation, so I'm assuming that they're happy to take bookings over the telephone.
Well, because I'm so sophisticated in my use of computers, I'll make sure it's on the LNL website.
Thank you.
Charlotte, thank you for that. That was a delight. That was just terrific.
Thank you.
On our next 8 years into the Afghanistan war, we'll talk to Afghan journalists about how things are looking on the ground and the life and times of Mary Wollstonecraft, yes, the Frankenstein woman, and also the author of The Vindication of the Rights of Women. It's her 250th birthday this year, and I've got to say she's looking good. Stick around on ABC Radio National for the news, and we'll see you later.